Good evening, and welcome to the North Oakland... North Oakland Speaker Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Evan. I'm an alcoholic and your secretary. What's up? Please turn off your cell phones. Please help me to open the meeting with a moment of silence followed by the Serenity Prayer. God,
grant you serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. I have asked Justin to read a portion of Chapter 3 of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous.
My name's Justin, I'm an alcoholic. More about alcoholism. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. All of us felt at times that we were regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. We are like men who have lost their legs. They never grow new ones. Neither does there appear to be any kind of treatment which will allow alcoholics of our kind, which will make alcoholics of our kind like other men. We have tried every imaginable remedy. In some instances, there has been brief recovery, followed always by a still worse relapse. Physicians who are familiar with alcoholism agree that there is no such thing as making a normal drinker out of an alcoholic. The science may one day accomplish this, but it hasn't done so yet. Despite all we can say, many who are real alcoholics are not going to believe that they are in that class. By every form of self-deception and experimentation, they will try to prove themselves exceptions to the rule, therefore non-alcoholic. If anyone who is showing inability to control his drinking can do the right about face and drink like a gentleman, our hats are off to him. Heaven knows we have tried hard enough and long enough to drink like other people. Here are some of the methods we have tried. Drinking beer only, limiting the number of drinks, never drinking alone, never drinking in the morning, drinking only at home, never having it in the house, never drinking during business hours, drinking only at parties, switching from scotch to brandy, drinking only natural wine, agreeing to resign if ever drunk on the job, taking a trip, not taking a trip, swearing off forever, with or without a solemn oath, taking more physical exercise, reading inspirational books, going to health farms and sanitariums, accepting voluntary commitment to asylum. We could increase the list ad infinitum.
Thank you. Horrible things. Okay. This is a speaker meeting. Ruby will speak for 10 minutes and then turn the meeting over to our main speaker, Chris, who will share his experience, strength, and hope. I'd like to introduce Ruby.
Hi. I'm Ruby. I'm an alcoholic.
Ruby!
This is my first...
Ruby!
Cool. All right. This is my
first... Ruby!
I have 10 minutes, so... Okay. This is my first time speaking at a meeting before. I am 16 years old. I have 7 months clean. I'm in between sponsors right now, but I have worked the steps. I go to meetings every day. I have commitments. I'm working on getting involved in H&I. I guess I'll start. My childhood is pretty good for the most part. I mean, I don't want to go into that, but... I started using when I moved in with my dad when I was 12. My cousin there smoked a bunch of weed. I was super depressed from running away from home from my mom, and one day we were on the bus home from school and she was like, you know, I smoke weed and if you ever want to, like, you can with me, like, no peer pressure at all. And immediately I was like, fuck yes, I want to smoke weed with you. And then every day we would, our parents would never be home, so at 5 in the morning we'd wake up, smoke weed, take the 2-hour bus ride to school, come home and smoke weed, and that was like my schedule every day in 7th grade. We lived on a farm out in the middle of nowhere. The farm got sold. We had to move to Oakland. 8th grade, I didn't really do anything. I didn't know where I would get anything. If I had a connection, I would have gone to it, but I didn't. I started hanging out with, like, the only kids that would smoke weed at my middle school, which were not a lot of them. So I didn't really do anything in 8th grade. But then 9th grade, for the first time, I had a really solid group of friends. They were all pieces of shit, but they were still my friends. They were really popular kids, and I was like, this is fucking cool, because I've never had, like, a group of friends that, like, accepted me because I was always, like, poor or my family was weird. Your mom's crazy. Your dad's also crazy. So hung out with them for a while. 2 months into high school, I started dating this kid for the pure reason to, like, be me. And I started dating him just so I could hurt him. And that was, like, the only reason that I dated him. And I broke up with him after, like, a month. And then him and this other boy thought it'd be really funny if they told a bunch of people that I, like, gave them head inside a movie theater. And then all my friends were like, it obviously happened if they said it did. And everyone was like, if you're the only one denying that rumor, then it must be true. I'm like, you guys are fucking stupid. And one thing led to another, and, like, it got to the point where everyone I was, like, was saying, she's getting, like, double teamed in the H building bathroom, and, like, she let the whole football team run a train on her when I, like, hadn't even had my first kiss yet. And I lost everyone. Like, I didn't hang out with anyone. I just hung out at home. I mean, it was fine. It sucked, but, I mean, it was fine for a while. People would say slut, and I'm like, I don't fucking care, whatever. Even if I was doing all that, it's none of your business. But then I started kicking it with this girl, Rosalie, who no one else liked because she smoked meth and, like, did hella drugs. And started hanging out with her all the time. We started smoking weed every day, and we'd take, like, shitty raver kid drugs and, like, not go to class. And we thought it was really cool, and it wasn't. And so started smoking a lot of weed and got arrested outside of my school. My dad figured out for the first time that I was smoking weed, shadowed me in class. That was great. And then after that, after those 3 days of going to school, I would just continuously miss more and more class just to ditch and go to my friend's house and get high and do whatever drugs he had. Eventually, me and my best friend, we kind of just, like, stopped going to class altogether. Like, we go to her first period, walk the track, and then ditch and go to our friend's house and just smoke weed. And then we started hanging out with these sketchy seniors that did a lot of coke and sold a lot of painkillers, and we got really into that. And that's when, like, everything went downhill really fast. Like, I did not have a lot of time to fuck up, but when I started to, it went down. Like, I stopped going to school. I went from smoking weed and, like, taking ecstasy and shrooms to, like, doing cocaine and taking Oxycontin with a bunch of freshman kids when I was 14. And I don't know, like, my parents knew that I was smoking weed. They didn't really know what else. Like, they put me in therapy, and I'd tell my therapist, who is a recovering addict, every day, I'd be like, it's okay, I can do it by myself. I promise I'll start going to school. I promise that I'll stop, like, just tomorrow, like, tomorrow, every time that I would see her. And I kept telling my parents that, and they drug tested me, and I'm like, I was like, yeah, there's going to be drugs in my system. Like, I've been smoking weed. And that was the worst mental state I've ever been in. I looked like shit. I was really skinny. There was not a time I wasn't high. And my mind state was, like, if I'm not high, like, I'm probably going to kill myself or someone else because there's no point for me to live without being high. Like, I'm going to die high. And then my parents let me fuck up for a while, and then I got sent to wilderness camp. And they still didn't know I was doing drugs. To their minds, like, I was just smoking weed and drinking or whatever. And I bullshitted it through the wilderness camp, came home, stayed sober for a month, and then got fucked up at my brother's friend's graduation party. Smoked weed and got super drunk. Almost got raped by my brother's 21-year-old friend. But a 9-year-old family friend, like, saved me from that. And that, I thought that that would be a wake-up call for me, but it wasn't. For the next 3 weeks that I was visiting, I was just getting drunk and high the whole time. I learned how to detox, so my piss test would be clean for when I came home. I passed a test. 2 days later, I came home hella stoned. My dad tested me, and I got grounded, but that did not stop me. I started dating this kid, got into, like, the worst relationship I possibly could have. He's a really bad alcoholic and a total piece of shit. And, yeah, any possible type of way that you can, like, abuse someone or harm someone, like, he did that to me. Like, he tore apart my confidence, fucking ruined my life. I didn't have any friends. Like, all my friends were his friends. Every day I was at his house, and that's why I was so scared to break up with him, was because I felt like I didn't have anywhere to go. Like, I'm not going to have any friends because I can't hang out with any of them anymore. Like, I cut everyone else off. I'm not going to have anything, so I just smoked weed for a while after wilderness camp, and then when things got super fucked up with that kid, I started doing a bunch of drugs again. Not to the extent that I did before, but it got pretty bad again. Finally broke up with him after his mom talked to me on the phone for 3 hours about how I needed to leave him. And I know, when your boyfriend's mom is, like, telling you that they need to, like, break up with your son, then, like, you probably should. And that's why I did. And that was the best decision I ever made while I was using. The only good decision I ever made when I was using. And then, I mean, I found friends. I found a bunch of stoners. Like, they were taking, like, stupid raver kid drugs. And then I started hanging out with this drug dealer who used to sell drugs in Richmond. This girl that was in the same grade as me. And she would always give me pills. Like, she would just, like, rifle through her bag and, like, dump shit out. And we just take it. Like, we would just, like, go on, like, pill identifier and, like, take it. And I'm like, I don't even care what it is. But yeah, I couldn't even, at that point, I was in independent studies, and I couldn't even make that happen. Like, I couldn't go to school for 2 hours a week and, like, do the 2 hours of homework that I would usually just copy off of the internet. I couldn't even make that happen. My parents put me in CDRP, and I stayed sober for 8 days, and then I got super drunk, and my friends had weed, and I was like, let's smoke. And then it just, I just kept smoking, didn't care, was detoxing sometimes, and then when I couldn't, I just would get someone else's piss, started doing a bunch of drugs again, didn't care. My parents still didn't know. They still didn't know. They thought I was just smoking weed because I would get someone else's pee because I knew it had to have, like, THC in it in the test, but I didn't want all these other, like, opiates and, like, fucked up shit showing up. And then I lasted about 5 months in CDRP before I was like, Mom, Dad, like, this obviously isn't working. Like, we need to get me out of this program because I'm not staying sober. And really, I just didn't want to have to worry about passing my drug test. I just wanted to keep fucking up without getting tested. And they were like, well, maybe we should think about sending you to rehab. And I was like, fuck, well, it's okay because that's hella expensive and they do not have money for that. And they talked to my CDRP counselor about it, and she got in touch with the Camp Recovery Center, which is a place where a lot of young people go. It's an adolescent and adult rehab. And they got in touch, and it was like, I was like, it's probably not going to happen. Then she showed up to my dad, and she was like, so your insurance is going to cover all of it, so there's no copay. And I was like, awesome, great. And then she was like, so in 2 weeks, you're going to rehab. And those 2 weeks were fucking crazy. I didn't sleep. I didn't do anything. I mean, besides drugs, we just got more drunk than I'd ever gotten in that entire 2 weeks in my life. Did more coke, took more painkillers, smoked more weed than, like, in the past 3 years that I had used. And then went to rehab, and that place is fucking amazing. Like, I still hang out with some of the girls in rehab, and I went there for 2 months. And the whole time I was super unsure about it, finally came clean to my parents about all the drugs that I was doing, got charges dropped against me because of my therapist there, which is really cool. And I made a lot of friends there, and a lot of them lived in the Bay Area, so I was like, you know, like, let's see how long I can keep this going. Like, I'm coming out of here with 60 days, like, let's see what if I can keep this going. Like, let's see if I can keep doing it. And I did. I stayed sober after rehab. I got out, like, 5 months ago, and What keeps me going is, first of all, the people in here. Like, if I had not cut off all my using friends before I came here, like, I would be nowhere. Like, if it weren't for the people in these rooms and, like, the friends I've made, I would still be using right now. Like, I'd still be doing the same shit that I was doing for the past 3 years. Like, nothing would have changed. And the other thing is, in rehab, they would always tell me, they'd be like, Ruby, out of all the people here, out of, like, all your friends, I guarantee that one or two of you are going to stay sober. And that is incentive for me, because in 3 years, when I go back to the camp and see all the people that work there, I want to be that one. Like, I want to be that one kid that stayed sober out of the bunch. Like, I want that to be me. Like, that's big incentive for me. And how I don't have to hide parents to my drugs. Wow, hide drugs in my parents' house, knowing that they're both recovering addicts. I don't have to do sketchy shit anymore. I don't know. It's like, I have had a lot of gifts in sobriety, but I've seen some bad shit too. My 15-year-old friend from rehab, one of my best friends, overdosed and died a couple months ago. I've seen a lot of people that I built really good relationships in the rooms go out. Some of them tried to come back in, but most of them just stay out. And it's like, they were right. They told me in rehab, I was like, bullshit, all of us are going to stay sober. And it's like, I think there's a good, like, four of us that actually stayed sober out of the group. And it's like, I'm still good friends with all of them, but it's hard. Like, I think about every day how, like, I'm never too young to die. Like, person that died, like, he was 15 years old. Overdosed on meth and heroin 2 weeks out of rehab. Like, this shit is serious. And that's, like, the thing that keeps me going. Like, I was doing shit like he was, and it's like, I could have easily died multiple times. It's like, I've done a lot of stupid shit when I was using. I didn't get that much time to fuck up, but when I did, I really fucked up. Like, it did not take that long. And I am grateful that I have parents that are in recovery that, as soon as I first got arrested, they were like, no, they were like, we're not taking any of this shit anymore. It's like, they did give me a little time to fuck up, but two different rehabs in a year period. So, yeah, I don't know. I'm so grateful for the people in these rooms. I'm so grateful for my parents supporting me through this and making it so much easier, and that my parents understand what I'm going through, and that they've supported me through stealing from them, lying to them, like, leaving the house, like, just breaking all the rules, outright disrespecting them, lying to them all the time. It's like, I don't know, there's nothing, like, my best friend's death, like, that wasn't enough for me to use. Like, I think about every day that there's nothing that is worth using to me now. Like, there's nothing that is more important to this than me. Like, nobody, nothing is more important to me than this, because it's, like, the best thing that's happened in my life. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Chris. I'm an alcoholic. Nervous as fuck, just because this is a big-ass room, but thank you, Mindy, for lining this up for me, and my friends for showing up. Welcome to all the new people. I hope you stick around. This is probably the most entertaining show in town. Is a big AA meeting where you get to watch other people try to straighten their lives out. Some succeed, some fail, but we all keep coming back, which is the key to success. My sobriety date's December 11th, 2004, and I've been trying to think how I wanted to share. I mean, I've done this, you know, off and on over the years, and I get bored telling my own story, so I try to, like, you know, start in the present and go to a flashback and tell me how I got sober in L.A., so everything is like, how can I edit my life to be an interesting storyline? Anyway, I'll just start when I started using and end for today. So, my first drink was at age 12, like Ruby, except I took a little longer to get to the point where I needed to get sober. It was with my friend Tommy Drake in New York when I was growing up, and his brother was out, and we went into the liquor cabinet, and we grabbed these giant, you know, glasses, and we took a shot of everything that he had in there, and a splash of Coke. He said, yeah, it's Long Island iced tea. I'm like, oh, okay. I had no idea. And we drank. I got about halfway through it, and then I started barfing, and that pretty much explains my drinking career. Which actually also explains why I moved to drugs. I could never hold any of my drugs or liquor down. It was interesting. I barfed on liquor. I barfed on cocaine. I didn't barf on speed. I took those. What do you call them? The loser.
Raver kid drugs.
Lame raver kid drugs. I loved those. Well, because I got high and they made me want to dance and they made me want to fuck. And that's what I liked. So. Oh, I forgot. I told my parents about this, and my mom and my sister want to get the podcast thingy when I'm like, can we edit that part out? I need to, like, censor it for them a little bit. I didn't do anything abnormal in high school. I drank here and there. You know, we got some... One of us ended up finding a way to buy beer, and we would, like, go to the woods and just sit around and pretend we were badass kids when we were really just nerdy dorks trying to act cool. And that's all I did in high school. I mean, I even went to Russia in 88 for a school organized. There was like about a dozen kids and some parents, and we all went. And I got offered weed and all kinds of stuff when I was there. I was still communist too, and I was scared as shit to like step outside the lines over there because they said like, the KGB is keeping an eye on you because you're American. And this is like the end of the Cold War. Berlin Wall was still up. There was still, you know, Gorbachev was in office. And I got offered weed to get in the car and go to this party and smoke weed, and I was too scared to do it. That's the kind of kid I was. I was like, I looked both ways before crossing the street. That kind of sums up my... I was the good kid. I was the middle kid, you know? And I went off to college, and I started smoking weed and found acid, which blew my mind, especially being in upstate New York where everybody's, like, deadheads. And for about 2.5 years, I did that nonstop almost every weekend, and you know, I did so much acid like my spine was hurting. They said it like messes with your spinal fluid or something like that, but I just remember like after 6 hours laying in bed going, make it stop. But and then I met somebody who, when I was 20 years old, I met this. I'd just come out of the closet. Surprise! I met someone at a nightclub in this town when I was going to school in Binghamton, New York, if anybody's familiar with upstate. The one of the two gay bars there at the time. And we just met and I went separate ways. And I was up there during the summer between school years and working at a hotel restaurant. He came walking around the corner. He was like some new waiter there, and I was like a busboy. Anyway, we ended up exchanging numbers and going on a date and started dating. I ended up being with this person for 12 years. So from 20 to 32, I was with this person. And when I met him, he had 5 years sober. He was going to meetings. For everybody who doesn't have to deal with coming out of the closet, who's, you know, hetero and that's not an issue, you know, gotta remember, I didn't have practice in high school dating. Like, it was not something that was happening, especially in the 80s. It is more so now for kids that come out early, but so I didn't know what it was like to have a crush on somebody, to have them be interested back and all that. So as soon as the first person turned their head to me, I'm like, marry me. even though it's not legal yet. But so literally after 6 months of dating him, he asked me to move to Dallas with him because that's where he was from. And of course, end of my junior year in college, I'm like, yeah. And so I moved to Dallas, changed majors, did everything I could to change myself to be more interested in him. I enrolled in school down there to architecture school. And things were fine for, you know, a few years. I went to school, got my degree, started working. And then for his 30th birthday, so this is like 5 years in, he was like, I want to do ecstasy. I haven't done it in a long time, and it's my 30th, and I want to have fun. And my idea of AA was like, I didn't think it was like medicine. I didn't think it was like something you needed to plug into on a regular basis. I thought it was, if you had a craving and needed a drink, you went to a meeting, otherwise you were cool. Which is funny because my grandfather was in AA back in the 40s, 50s. I mean, he was like one of the early ones in AA. There's a rehab in on the Chesapeake Bay called Father Martin's Ashley House, and Father Martin actually spoke at my grandfather's funeral because he worked for Father Martin, and like I think he went there to that rehab. My aunt Patricia went there. My cousin Bobby went there. So I think we have like a wing devoted to our family. I'm surprised I didn't go there actually, because when they did my intervention, I ended up in California instead of Maryland, which I'm kind of grateful for. Anyway, 5 years in, he wanted to do ecstasy. I was like, awesome. I've never done it before. Let's do it. Raver drug. And I never felt so good in my life. Yeah, I was still drinking all the time. Yeah, Peter, oh my God, I'm sorry. Sorry, honey. Jonathan was the guy's name, and he didn't care if I drank. He didn't care if I drank, but it turns out he was pretty much a sociopath anyway. He was lying from day one, manipulating me. It's hard to explain with I don't want to deviate on all that, but he was basically a manipulator, and I was a codependent, insecure, blossoming addict. And after he wanted to do drugs and I agreed, it was on from there. But before that, we used to like to go out. We were in upstate New York, and we'd drive into the city, and he'd like feed me drinks all night long and get me drunk, and he lived vicariously through me. He wasn't exactly the healthiest sober guy that apparently. I didn't realize that at the time. I'm just like, awesome, he's getting me drunk. But I would like, I remember one time we were in New York and got a room, and I blacked out, and he disappeared for a couple hours. Like, if I had any wits about me, I would have kind of put two and two together at that point and not wasted 12 years. But anyway, we started down this downward spiral, and then we would ended up going to bathhouses on the weekends and partying and dancing and fucking and just doing, whatever. And he couldn't keep a job. He ended up getting arrested by the FBI because apparently he cheated. He used his ex's credit card in New York, and when we moved to New York, he was actually like running away from charges, and they found him and brought him back to New York. So I was in Texas by myself living with his mother when he was back in prison in jail in New York for a few months. And anyway, you'd think, red flag, red flag, red flag. I'm so fucking stupid. I couldn't believe it, but I saw what I wanted to see. So that's what it is, and that's kind of my whole life, actually, is I see what I want to see, at least until I got sober. Gradually, the ecstasy and the GHB and the pot and what else was there? GBL, if anybody ever tried that? That was fucking awesome for a minute, all these designer drugs were all over the place. And then eventually crystal just made its way into the picture, and that's all anybody had, and that's all I ended up doing because that's all anybody fucking had. And I couldn't get anything else, and it was just annoying, and I was like, fine. And I ended up, losing 100 pounds, losing about 4 teeth, and staying up all night, and killing my dog accidentally because she would lick mess up off the floor when we spilled it. I lost 2 jobs, got fired. I had sex in my office after hours with people while I was cheating on my husband because I needed a tie, I needed sex, and that was the only place I had to go where he wasn't there. He died, age 37. He got arrested several times. I sold my 401k that I had at the time to bail him out. And he came out of jail one time with like a sore on his shoulder, and it turned out it was a staph infection, and he was like trying to, he thought it was like a boil, and was trying to pop it, and it... Sorry. Just YouTube it. It's beautiful. It ruptured under his skin and got into his bloodstream, and he ended up getting staphylococcal pneumonia and went to the hospital and was in a medically induced coma and on breath, life support so that his body could heal. And eventually he healed. He woke up. But he had permanent lung damage, and he had congestive heart failure as a result. And a year later, he died of heart failure. And all that's because drugs. You probably know meth heads get a lot of staph infections, and that's just how it started. So now everybody dies of an overdose or suicide or anything like that. Some people have slow, agonizing deaths, and he was one of them. That wasn't enough to get me to stop. I actually wanted to obliterate myself after that happened, because right before he died, the dog died. The week after he died is when I got fired from one of those jobs, and while I was out of town at his parents' house for the funeral, that my house got robbed and all the anything of value got stolen. So it was kind of like this, hi, here's your bottom, and just shoving your face in the dirt, scrapping it over and over and over again. It was just like one thing after the other, and by the time everything was done, I was like, fuck. So I did what I could to get as much drugs as I could, and basically he died in July of 2004, and from July to November, I just did what I could to obliterate myself and do as much as I could. And I would try to stop using drugs, and I would go to 7-Eleven to buy a 12-pack of beer or a bottle of vodka, and that's what I would do until I couldn't take it anymore. Then I'd go and buy more drugs, and or I'd scam myself into getting more drugs. I would get some money from somebody, buy a half a pound of meth, sell 3 1/4 of the pound, and I keep a quarter for myself. And, you know, I had all these, like, schemes to, like, get free drugs, and I was so fucking tired and exhausted and hungry and broke, and somehow, I remember, I had 2 moments of clarity right before I got sober. One, it's Halloween weekend, and I was out, I don't know, doing something important at 4 a.m. And I remember driving back, and up the street from the apartment building I lived in, there was an intersection, and in the intersection there was this guy, buck naked, running around in circles under the street light. And it sounds kind of funny, but it was a really haunting image, and I was just like, wow, he's really fucked up. And, you know, meanwhile, I'm like, oh. But that image always stayed in my head. I'm like, oh my god, I never want to be that guy. And then another day, probably a couple days after that, I was getting out of the shower, and I looked up and saw myself in the mirror, and I could see my ribs. And I was like, oh my god, help me. And I don't know if everybody had, I hear a lot of speakers in AA, and CMA is a big part of my sobriety, because in LA, the Christian Meth Anonymous is a huge fellowship down there, and there's some over here in the East Bay, if anybody's interested. I lost my train of thought. I heard a lot of speakers say, you know, they had that moment where they see themselves and they say something, and they just kind of have this minor moment of surrender where you say, God, help me. And that was kind of the turning point. A week later, I managed to find a job. Like I said, I went to architecture school, and I had some success at that, but I managed to get a part-time contract position because that's all I was capable of. And I went to my first day on the job, and I was so broke, I was going to come home for work, for lunch. So I drove home for lunch, and I went to open the door, and I hit something. And I was like, this is in Texas, mind you, in Dallas, where I lived at the time. And I opened the door, and the door hit my brother, who lives in Philadelphia. And there's my sister, who lives in D.C., and there's my parents, who live in Delaware. And there's the guy in the suit, who down the road was going to be on the show Intervention. And I'm like, huh. And there's a using friend of mine sitting in the bed looking at me like, I don't know what the fuck's going on. All of a sudden they all pull out these letters. And I'm like, oh god. And of course I'm like looking around for the pot and the drugs paraphernalia, like, oh shit, did they see anything? And of course they saw it all. They were there for an intervention. You know, my parents came down for my partner's funeral, and they kind of saw me and were like, oh, something's wrong with him. And then my sister came down, I had a garage sale after he died to kind of unload a lot of tweaker shit we had in the house. And, the house was torn apart. The kitchen was completely gutted. We were like, I was like a guy that liked to have sex on drugs, surrounded by a bunch of people that liked to do like projects and like. So if anybody's done meth, you know that there's project tweakers, there's skin pickers, and there's the sex freaks. So I was the third, and everybody else I surrounded myself with was the other two. So it was really annoying, but for one of those reasons, anyway. So the intervention happened, and basically, I've never really knew about interventions and what they were. I thought it was everybody confronting you about your problem, but it's not. It's everybody telling you how your addiction and your problems have affected their lives. And they basically lay out what their life has in it because you use drugs. And my mother laid it out for me, and I cried like a baby. And then my dad laid it out for me. He started crying, then I started crying some more. Then my brother laid it out for me. Then he started crying. Then I started crying. And then by the time it came to my sister, I couldn't even hear anymore. And I actually stepped outside. The door rang. The doorbell rang. And I opened the door. And it's the guy I used to buy drugs from during my intervention. And he's like, "Have you seen Joe or somebody?" I'm like, "There's kind of an intervention." He's like, "Oh, sorry, sorry." He's like, "Here's $20. He's like, "Joe, Joe is." I'm like, "Yeah, he's so-and-so's house." He's like, "Thanks." And like walks off. I'm like, "Okay." And just an odd little commercial break in my intervention. Anyway, I step outside, and my friend Eric, who was there with me, comes out there with me, and so I can smoke a cigarette and freak out. And he's like, "You should go." And I'm like, "Well, I'm not an addict." And he's like, "I knew. Seriously, I didn't think I had a problem. I could stop. I stopped for 2 days before to get my job and clear my head." Meanwhile, my tooth is cracking as I, speak. So I got on a plane that night, and I was headed to L.A., and I was in a, there's a, Ken Seeley, the guy that did my intervention, had a sober living house out there that I stayed in, and it was, it saved my life. It wasn't a rehab, like a locked door rehab. It wasn't a sober living where you just had to stay sober and, you could live your life there. It was a very structured kind of a recovery home. And the requirements were a meeting every day, I had to come back with 3 phone numbers and I had to put them in the log. And I had to call those numbers the next day and write down when I called them and what time and whether I had a conversation or whether I left a voicemail. There's this game, this computer game that Deepak Chopra developed called The Wild Divine, and it's, you put these sensors on your fingers. And it basically, it's kind of like a, experiential game where you kind of guide through this, like, it's like Myst, and everybody remembers Myst from like, I'm 42, it's like that was the hot game when I was young. But in order to go to the next stage, you had to do these breathing exercises, and it monitored your heart rate, and it kind of like, it caught, basically the whole theory behind this place I went and got sober was that, there was a physical reaction to having a craving that your body, that you could kind of work towards controlling to help with your cravings. It wasn't like proposing itself as a solution to addiction, but it was like, the theory was when you have a craving, your capillaries constrict and your fingertips get cold. So we did these finger warming exercises where we had to like try to raise the temperature of our hands, and we did these breathing exercises to kind of slow our heart rate down, and it helped a lot. And we were required to do an hour of meditation in the morning and an hour in the evening as a group. And I did that for 30 days, and I decided to stay in California because I had started making friends, and I broke down in tears one night saying thank you out loud, because after my first meeting, I didn't have any money. I was there broke. My parents had to like shove some money in my pocket as we went out the door so I could actually have food, because this place didn't feed you. After my first meeting, this guy who I'd never met was like, let's all go eat. And I was like, I didn't want to go because I didn't have any money. And he's like, don't worry about it. And I'd never had anybody buy me a meal ever, actually. It was IHOP. I mean, it was nothing special, but I had never experienced generosity like that. Like, he just paid for my meal and let me eat. And I went to another meeting, and it was a round robin format. And I still remember it was in LA, the West Hollywood Recovery Center, which is across the street from the Log Cabin, which, if anybody knows LA, those are like the two sober hubs in that part of town. It's like 40 people there. I was about 2/3 of the way around the circle, and people started sharing, and it was like, oh, I feel less than. Oh, I've cracked my teeth. Oh, I've been arrested. Oh, it was like every part of my story was told as the people went around the room, and she spoke for 2 or 3 minutes. And by the time it got to me, I was like, I started crying again. I'm a big crier, apparently. And I finally felt like there's people that got it. That knew what I had been through, because they just told exactly what happened in my life up until it got to me. And 3 people gave me their numbers right afterwards. And of course, being the good soldier that I was in the house, I called them the next day. But I had never felt more connected in my life. I had been this lonely, desperate, codependent, drug addicted, insecure mess for years, who had gotten his ass beat by the person he thought he loved. and got arrested 3 times, sold drugs in the bathhouse, chased drag queens down the street with a stun gun. Yeah. Her name was Angel. She's like tall, black, and blonde wig. You're like, she looked like RuPaul, but... I had a gun for a little while. I pulled a gun on some people that come to my house because they weren't supposed to be there. You know, sorry, Mom. I keep forgetting that she's going to hear this if I send her the link, so... Anyway, it's all right. Anyway, I flew back to Dallas to get my stuff, and I went back to this Mexican restaurant where I worked for a little while just to see some people and had a margarita, and I got about halfway through and was like, huh, probably shouldn't have done that. So my original sobriety date was November 8th. I changed it to December 11th because it was a month later and I drank the margarita, and you know, I don't think I even got tipsy off of it, but to be honest, that's what I did. I resented the fact that I had to do that, because, but I did. For 3 months, I was like, alcohol wasn't my big drug. It was, you know, that's why I always just say alcoholic in meetings, because alcohol wasn't my problem. Crystal wasn't my problem. Coke wasn't my problem. My problem was up in between my ears. My solution was all of those things. And my solution worked for a long time. And then it didn't work anymore. My solution stopped working. And that's why I was sputtering along, because I couldn't get high anymore. If I drank, I'd throw up. If I tried to manipulate and tried to blame, nobody was buying it anymore. So all my little solutions stopped working. And I needed a new way. And I was so tired of scamming and lying and cheating and trying, searching for money, trying to make deals. I had, you know, my friend and I, the abusing friend who was in the room for my intervention, he and I had an eBay scam where we would, like, post video games on eBay, accept the money, the buy now money, and then close our account, and then, like, we'd, like, make money doing that, and get to the ATM before they busted us and get some cash, and, you know, it was fucked up. I had a Home Depot scam where I would, like, put fake barcodes on the materials at Home Depot, and I would carry them to the self-checkout line and scan, like, a $2 thing when it was actually a $40 thing, and then I would go back to Home Depot and with a sticker peel off and return it for $40, and, you know, I had all kinds of crazy little ways to make money, and, you know, except for getting a job, but... So when I was in L.A. and got sober and realized I wanted to stay, I moved out there, and I just started my life, you know? I did 90 and 90 as best as I could. I got a job in my field for making less than I had, but it was still in my field, and I just got back on the horse career-wise. And just started doing the do. You know, my first sponsor walked me through the first 3 steps, and he was new at this. He was only like a year ahead of me in sobriety and had never had a sponsee, so he wasn't sure how to work the steps. I didn't have any clue. And but so we got the NA workbook. If anybody's done the NA steps, the NA workbook's a lot of fucking questions. I mean, it's like step one, here's 100 questions that you have to answer. I was like, God damn. So we did that, we went through it, and you know, the first 3 were, you know, they're all just about, you know, making sure you understand where you are and that you have a problem, and that you are not the end-all be-all to the world. And I remember, I never really had a problem with the whole God thing. But I remember somebody put it this way. They said, okay, well, how was rising the sun this morning? Did you have any hard time getting the sun in the sky? Like, what do you mean? They're like, well, you're in control, right? So you raised the sun. And I'm like, okay, I get it. Fine. Yes, I didn't cause the tide. I get it. So there's obviously something bigger than me. I just say God because I haven't figured it all out yet. I don't know if I ever will. A lot of people have a problem with the whole God thing. To me, it just means that I'm not in control. You know, I make my own decisions. That got me into rehab. So, you know, my decisions got me into the gutter. And my decisions got me arrested. And my decisions made me have to seek help. And I got help. After the first 3 steps, my sponsor kind of faded away. He ended up relapsing and going out and drinking. And I switched sponsors, and he worked me through the 4th and 5th step. And that was kind of enlightening, you know. The 4th step was really hard for me. I would write one thing down and then throw the notebook across the room. Because I hated thinking about that shit. I would get pissed, and I would get upset. And I just was like, it was tough. It took me like 6, 7, 8 months to get it done, just because I would refuse to do the writing. I would write one little thing or think about writing one little thing, and like, go do something else that I could distract myself with. But when I did it, I did the fifth step with him and read it all, and he pointed out some things that I had no clue were going on in the background. Like, he's like, oh, common thread, here. And I was like, okay. I just had no idea. It helped to read out the four columns to him and have him kind of point out some things that I hadn't seen. And it was kind of mind-opening. So if you're stuck on the fourth step or in the middle of doing your fourth step, I'd encourage you to just even if it's not as thorough as you would like, which mine was not, just get it to a point where you can do your fifth step with your sponsor, because it will open your eyes. You can always do another one, and I'm and another, and another. And I ended up switching sponsors again because there was some gay drama around him, and I just got tired of it. There's this sober thing in Palm Springs every fall called Hot and Dry. It's the LA, the gay LA AA group goes out there and has a convention, basically, and it's kind of like, you know, Mean Girls summer camp. It's really but no, but it does. I'm doing it a disservice, actually. It's an amazing experience on a lot of levels. The meetings are fantastic. The people you meet are amazing. But there's a lot of, like, stupid little gossipy things that happen. And in this one thing, I heard that my sponsor was talking shit about me. And I was like, okay, I'm not going to see him anymore. I'm just going to find a new sponsor. And I was at a meeting downtown L.A. on my lunch break at the Y downtown. And I shared about that. And this guy came up to me after the meeting and says, do you have somebody in mind who you want to be your sponsor? And I said, yeah, I do, actually. I just have to ask him. He goes, well, why don't you call him? I'm like, okay, I will. He goes, no, no, no. Take your phone out. And he stood there. I'm like, really? He goes, yeah, call him. And I'm like, all right, I'll call him. And I dialed the phone, and I called, and I kind of like did this and went to and left a message. I turned around, and the guy was gone. He was the impetus to get me to do it. And I still don't know who he is. I don't know what he looked like. Didn't know his name. That meeting I went to occasionally when I could in my work schedule to catch a meeting if I knew I was going to, you know, just to check in the middle of the work week. And that sponsor was with me for, excuse me, burpee, until I moved here. So, and I've never been the best at contacting sponsors. I'm really bad at calling them, sorry. My current one is in the room now, and we're supposed to get together tomorrow to do some work, so yay. But I've always been bad about doing it. I don't know why. It's a suppressed resentment against authority kind of thing. I haven't identified it because I don't see them as authority figures, but I think subconsciously there's something there that makes me put them in that position. My sponsor now is very cool, and I adore him and his wife, and I'm really happy to be part of this fellowship. You know, I moved up here a year and a half ago. I got laid off from my job in LA and came up here with my partner now. And we've got a house, and we're just making things happen again. It's interesting relocating after being sober in one spot all my program. I've had to kind of reset my thinking back to when I was new again and, like, reach out and meet people and get numbers, and I've been really sucky at it. Because, I mean, I know about a dozen people in this room, but I've been here a year and a half. When I was in L.A. a year and a half, I knew, like, hundreds of people. So, but I wasn't working and was in rehab and made to go to meetings every day. So here I'm working hard and getting to about two meetings a week. But, you know, there's a lot of familiar faces. I don't know a lot of people here yet still, but the ones I do, I really like a lot. I'm grateful to that. Everybody's opened their hearts to me. And, you know, I got about a minute left or so, and I would just urge everybody to work the steps. Stay in touch. Come back. Even if you fuck up, just come back. There's no reason to not come back. You know, we're not a cult. We're not here for anything but ourselves. We're not, you know what I mean? Like, we're here to stay sober, and we stay sober by helping you. We stay sober by listening to you. We stay sober by working with you. So if you don't show up, we get into trouble. We end up faltering. So we need you here. I need you here because, you know, my mind starts drifting. I go to less and less meetings occasionally when I get busy or, you know, think I'm getting busy, and I don't think about using. I mean, I've got almost 10 years. I don't think about using or drinking, but the old way of thinking starts coming in. Like, I don't have to do that. I'm good. I'm fine. I can handle this. And I start getting a little wonky. I start getting a little manic. And I start thinking things that lead me down the road to get towards relapse. And thanks to the program, I'm aware of what those thoughts are. That's what I got put in my toolkit, is the awareness of that's the wrong way to go. This is the way I need to go. You know, that path may look pretty and cute and fun, but there's a black hole at the end that, you know, whereas this one keeps going. And I'm just so grateful to have my life. I'm so grateful to have the man I have in my life today who's got 30 years sober. So he'll probably end up being a speaker here eventually. Thank you. I appreciate it.